Good morning. We are ready for argument in case number 10-21-22, National Labor Relations Board versus White Oak Manor. Ms. Lancia, please come forward. Whenever you're ready. Well, it, as I understand it, this is a petition for enforcement. Whoever wishes to come to the podium may come to the podium.
Good morning. My name is Tom Kine, and I represent White Oak Manor, which is a long-term care company with a facility in Shelby, North Carolina. This is a case that started with a bad haircut, and that's why we're here today. It's a National Labor Relations Act case, and the primary issue is whether Ms. Wright engaged in protected concerted activity for mutual aid and protection of herself and others. It's undisputed that there was no union activity ongoing. And I know the court's familiar with the facts, but in two sentences, we just say Ms. Wright received a bad haircut. She wanted to cover it up with a ball cap. She refused to remove the ball cap, so she was given a written warning. And thereafter, her employment was terminated for taking photographs of other employees without their permission.
Mr. Kine, I take it you don't contend that this matter is moot.
No, I don't.
Because you settled with her.
Yes, sir.
So,
no,
no problem with her. She didn't want the job back. Right?
That's correct.
And so you settled. But I take it the board's position would be that there's a likelihood of similar or like kind violations, and therefore the board wants to be ordered.
What the board wants is for us to post the notice.
Exactly.
Enforce
the remainder of the order that's
right.
Not related directly to the complaint.
That's correct. Case has been settled with regard to Ms. Wright. She's waived reinstatement, and she has.
But it's not moved.
No, Your Honor. If you see the notice that they won't post it, it has information in it regarding Ms. Wright.
I just want to make sure. I thought that's where we all were.
Yes, sir.
And the question, I mean, does the notice need any? Is there an issue with the notice?
Yes. The notice does not reflect that the matter has been resolved with regard to Ms. Wright, and it indicates that she will be reinstated and that she will be given back.
So the notice needs to be...
It's effective. And the judge's order, the administrative law judge's order, indicates that if the case is enforced, that the notice, instead of saying pursuant to an order of the National Labor Relations Board, would be changed to say pursuant to an order of the United States Court of Appeals. And so
that's not what you're here complaining about. Or is it? Maybe.
No, I'm saying, look, I hope we don't.
I mean, that's
that
a matter. That's a matter for you and Miss Lucy to work out, and you can agree on the verbiage of the order.
No, no, sir.
No?
No, sir. If this court enters an order that says
forget what this court does.
Oh.
I mean, just in terms of the administrative order, you're not here complaining about some language in the order, are you? Well, maybe you are.
Well,
I don't know.
I mean, I hope we don't get to where the language of the order is an issue. If we prevail, there's no issue with regard to the order.
I think we understand your position, but I do have an ongoing question.
Okay, I'm
about
sorry.
That. And perhaps, as far as I'm concerned, if you want to proceed with your argument, that I did have a question.
I'm sorry.
But go ahead.
Well, I understand. I missed the question. I apologize.
My question, I think, with respect to the notice, there does seem to be a disagreement with respect to the notice.
There is a disagreement, and the way the board and the administrative law judge issues the orders, those orders indicate that the appendix, the notice in the appendix, shall be posted. within 14 days of receipt from the regional office. And in footnote 5 to the judge's opinion, he indicates that in the event the order is enforced by a United States Court of Appeals, that the appendix, which is the notice, shall be altered to say that it's being posted pursuant to an order of the United States Court of Appeals.
Is that typical?
Yes, sir. What happens when a United States Court of Appeals issues an order enforcing a board decision to not follow that order? My position would be she would be in contempt.
You're not concerned about that particular process. You're concerned about the content of the order.
Correct.
Correct.
All right. The with regard to whether or not Ms. Wright engaged in effective concerted activity for the mutual aid and protection of herself and other employees, the record is clear that Ms. Wright testified under oath at both the administrative hearing and at her unemployment hearing, and in her own words stated that she acted solely on her own, that she was not acting on anyone else's behalf. And what is key here, and what's key in the National Labor Relations Act, is that employees act in concert, that they act collectively. The Act does not protect an individual employee asserting a single right. It doesn't protect that. It requires two or more or one on behalf of a group. That is clear law, and in this case, the administrative law judge Cullen, so much as admitted in his opinion that her initial complaints were individual, and that somehow her efforts to have to be able to wear a ball cap evolved, was the term he used, into protected concerted activity.
But wasn't that something that is that a credibility question? Perhaps what she said at the unemployment conversation hearing was it could be interpreted as that was her initial concern, but as she began to explore what she felt was an inconsistency of enforcement, her concern did evolve into a broader, say, inquiry.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that. The key of this is her testimony came after all of this happened. It's not it appears to me that Judge Cullen looked at this testimony as if it were given at the start of this process, but it wasn't. It was given at the end, after all of this had transpired. And there is no evidence in the record that anybody else wanted to wear a ball cap, and there is no way that, I mean, we have presented
the
most
testimony at the unemployment hearing was about her cap. That was the focus of the discussion, not about the policy.
What testimony was is whether she was acting on behalf of anybody else or solely on her own.
Well, I guess the way you phrase it, that might be seen as being mutually exclusive, but the board's position is that she wanted to both wear a hat as an individual, but also wanted to enforce the dress code. Those are not mutually exclusive propositions, right?
That you wanted to change the dress code?
Or have the dress code enforced even.
That still, if that's the case, that still is her own concern.
I don't know if that's correct. It's a mix. Both her individual desire to have the, to be able to wear the hat, but the fact that she also wanted, part and parcel of that, to have the dress code enforced evenly, those are not inconsistent propositions.
No, they're not, but her actions to do that is not for the mutual aid or protection of any more employees than herself. That's the problem with her case, is that all the actions she took place that she did were to benefit her and nobody else. That's the problem with her case. She has to show it's mutual aid and protection of herself and others,
but
not just
herself. Can you acknowledge it's evidence that needs equivocal? If she wanted the whatever the dress code was enforced evenly, does that not of necessity apply more broadly than to her?
No, because she didn't want it to change for anybody else. That's what she said.
But she wanted it forced across the board. She wanted the same policies to apply wanted the policy to apply to him.
Assuming that's what...
That's a fair... that is not an unfair characterization of what she said.
That, even that given, doesn't... It's not for the mutual aid or protection of anybody but herself. That's the problem that she's got with the case. The National Labor Relations Act is not about what's fair and fair enforcement. It's not got anything to do with that. What it has to do with is whether people join together to change things at their workplace. That's what it's all about. You know, she pursued an EEOC charge as well, and the intake questionnaire is in that, in the record, and you read that intake questionnaire, which was signed under oath, and it says, I was mistreated. I was treated differently. It doesn't say anything about female employees being treated differently. It says, I was. It says, other employees could wear hats. She photographed, according to the evidence, males and females. This was about her, not about whether the females were being treated differently, not about whether any other employees were being treated differently. It was about whether she was being treated fairly. That was her position and what she was trying to change.
But isn't there evidence in the record that, in fact, when she began speaking to her fellow employees, there were others who shared her concern and her grievance about this issue? So I don't think it's fair to characterize it as an individual mission on her part.
No, it was. And there's, Your Honor, I would disagree with that. There's authority for...
Disagree with the record or disagree?
No, disagree with that point. Just because I talk to a group of employees and I say, I am upset with the dress code. I want the dress code to be changed. Doesn't mean that I'm doing that for the mutual aid and protection of anybody other than me.
Well, you've forgotten the second part of that. Not only did she talk to them, but then those fellow employees agreed with her and said that they had a similar grievance.
Well, assuming they shared a similar interest in having the dress code changed, there was no mutual aid or protection. There was no action to do that for their mutual aid and protection. And other employees having an interest. The board law is clear. Other employees who have an interest in a particular policy or wages or benefits or whatever, that's not strong enough to constitute mutual aid or protection for more than a single employee. And I'm sorry.
The ALJ found in the board agreed that what initially started out as an individual complaint evolved into a campaign to have the dress code enforced in a fair and equitable manner. What deference do we owe to the board?
Right.
And why?
Because it's an error of law. There is no evidence in the record to contradict Ms. Wright's testimony, whereby you can put facts together to find it was for the mutual aid or protection of a group of employees. It she has testified. No, Your Honor, I would disagree with that. The cases we cited, they show that just because other employees have an interest in a policy or think something has been done unfairly does not rise to the level of her expressing her own individual complaint being for the mutual aid and protection of other employees. And Judge Cullen, one of the cases we cited, the Media General case, Judge Cullen was the judge on that case. It was a similar case, and the board reversed it. Okay, and said, no, there was no effective concerted activity for the mutual aid or protection of more than one employee. And that's where an employee complained that another employee that was related to the supervisor was treated fairly, treated more deferential, was given better treatment. That was an organized facility. The union steward was with him. Judge Cullen found that effort constituted protected concerted activity, and the board reversed. Now, we don't have anything close to that. But the case was, you know, enforced in its norm, not necessarily normal, but without comment from the board.
But what, in your opinion, would have been required to make the case of this record of insufficient? What else?
For the board?
Yes.
They would have had to establish that more than one person was seeking to have the dress code changed. And it would have to have been for more than one person's benefit.
Well, didn't the petitioner in this case work together with another employee to make
Another employee was present and asked an employee whether a photograph could be taken. We don't believe that constitutes, under the plenty of authority, concerted activity that's protected. But even if that's the case, it's not for the mutual benefit of more than one employee. It's only for the benefit of Ms. Wright, who doesn't want to, who wants to be able to wear a hat.
But we have said that action by an individual is concerted as long as it is intended to enlist the support of an individual.
It has to be for the mutual protection. It has to be for more than one employee's benefit. Even if a group of employees...
No, I mean, I don't know that the president makes that additional point.
It's definitely a joint requirement. It has to be protected, concerted activity, and it has to be for the mutual benefit of more than one employee. It is definitely a dual requirement. I see I'm almost out of time. I'd be happy to continue or answer any questions.
Well, you have some time remaining to move on.
Yes.
If you wish to continue now, or you can pick up your bottle.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Nicole Lancia, and I represent the Board in this case seeking enforcement of its order finding that the company White Oak Manor unlawfully threatened to discharge and interrogated employees Wright and Hawkins because of their engagement in protected concerted activity and discharged Wright for that activity. The issue here is whether Nicole Wright Gore engaged in protected concerted activity by having multiple conversations with at least 10 female employees and 3 members of management about the company's unfair enforcement of the dress code, and more importantly, with Hawkins' assistance, sought to document that inequity by photographing employees in violation of the dress code and the company's failure to discipline them. As counsel was pointing out, there is a requirement, dual requirement, that the activity must be protected and concerted and for mutual aid or protection. But mutual aid or protection is defined as an action that seeks to improve terms and conditions of employment, as well as resolve or call attention to those terms and conditions of employment, as the photograph did.
How do you mean this is the purpose of using all the management?
How does that cut one way or the other?
Well, that demonstrates that Wright made management and even higher officials at headquarters aware of what her issue was. She did say that she had gotten a write-up, but she also mentioned that it was unfair that the company did not enforce its dress code fairly. So it was at that point that more officials than just those in the immediate facility became aware of the issue. And if knowledge were disputed in this case, that would be a highly relevant factor. But as the ALJ found, it was not disputed that the company, through Nelson and managers Gunter and Walker and others, had knowledge that she was talking to employees about this unfair issue, and she was seeking to initiate group action and call attention to it by taking these pictures as proof.
So, well, going back to my question, it would seem that you were saying that it is simply one of a number of factors. It is really possible that it could cut both ways. It could be called to inquire about a personnel action that affects you only. So
well, she would
have to judge it in the context of other circumstances.
Right. Well, actually, when she did call and speak to the headquarters personnel, it was almost immediately after she had received the write-up. And as this court acknowledged, the ALJ and the board agreed that it might have started as an individual gripe about the hat and about her insubordination and refusing to take it off, but it evolved into joint action where she began not only talking with multiple employees, including Hawkins, in the presence of management and to management officials themselves, but also began using her cell phone as a modern use of technology to try to demonstrate, as opposed to words, actually demonstrate what the issue was and what employees' shared concerns over the dress code were.
What are we to make of the arguable conflicting testimony in the interview?
Well, as I believe Judge Diaz stated earlier, there are not mutually exclusive concepts. She did want to wear the hat, and she did feel like she was being treated unfairly, but she also wanted the dress code fairly enforced. And a point that we make in our brief is there is no reference to any time frame for which she felt that she was being treated unfairly. It doesn't say on what day. So we don't know if this was still in the individual gripe stage or if this was after she had begun taking the photograph.
Valencia, counsel for the respondent at one point in his argument indicated that we owe no deference to the board's view of this matter. Is that right?
No, I would like to actually address that because, as the court stated in Air Products and Chemicals, protected concerted activity and the board's finding of whether action is protected and concerted activity is a factual finding and therefore is accorded substantial evidence. Is under that standard. So whether substantial evidence on the record as a whole supports the board's finding that the activity was protected concerted activity.
So even if there were an equally reasonable interpretation of these events, the board wins under that standard.
Yes, because substantial evidence is such evidence as a reasonable mind might accept to support that finding. And even if the court had it heard the record and heard the case in the first instance, might have came out a different way. If the board's conclusions are supported by substantial evidence on the record as a whole, then it must uphold that decision. I'd also like to make a comment on the nature of the order. I understand there was an issue regarding the wording of it. I just wanted to call this court's attention to the board's process that even if this court does enforce the order and the language stands as it is when it is enforced, if it is enforced, the board has typically compliance proceedings after the Court of Appeals makes a decision, and that's where the issues as to the particular facts of the case are resolved in terms of what has been settled, what has not. She didn't accept reinstatement with the company they offered then, and she rejected it. But that would be something that would be handled in a compliance proceeding and not something that this court has to concern itself with now. The board also found that while Wright's conduct was protected concerted activity in acting with other employees and Hawkins, and it was for mutual aid of protection because they sought to call attention to and hopefully improve the conditions of employment, namely the dress code, they also found, importantly, that her conduct was not sufficiently egregious to lose the act's protection. The company admittedly discharged her because she allegedly took a photograph of another employee, DC Brooks, without his permission and showed it to other employees. But the company did not show that the conduct that they are claiming was misconduct ever occurred. And moreover, they never disseminated a known workplace rule to employees requiring them to obtain permission before photographing other employees. So not only is the record there on whether she even took the picture, but it's questionable whether that even would have been misconduct in the first place. And that just goes to the employer's awareness of her concerted activity from the conversations to the photograph and that she was discharged because of that activity, although for the wrong reason. If there are no further questions, I'll just briefly conclude by urging this court to see, as Wright did, the forest through the trees. This was not about the hat. This was about a larger issue of the company failing to enforce its dress code evenly and fairly for everybody. And she sought to reform that, though prompted perhaps by an initial individual concern. She noticed that other employees also shared these concerns and had been disciplined for actions which other employees were not disciplined for. And she was fired because of her efforts to reform that. Therefore, this court should enforce the board's order in its entirety. Thank you.
Just a couple of points, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you have, obviously. But in this case, facts are key or undisputed. you review this record, they're undisputed. She acted alone for her own benefit. Therefore, this court may review the facts, apply it to the law, for the de novo legal review, and rule that this order should not be enforced. No matter what evidence that there is out there, it does not overcome Ms. Wright's own admission that she was acting solely on her own behalf. Again, this testimony given after all these events that transpired twice in both proceedings when she was under oath. In addition, the only other sworn document in this case is her EEOC intake questionnaire. She never says a word in there about anybody being treated differently except herself. Whether that's fair, whether she was treated fair, is not an issue in this case. She's got to show that more than just herself took this action, and more than just herself was the intended beneficiary. That's what she cannot prove, because she has admitted that it was only for the benefit of her, and it was only her act.
Counsel, I guess I'm so concerned about how you view the standard of review, because even if we agree that the facts are undisputed, I mean, our precedent, I'll just read you a quote. It says here, this is a secret case, or I maybe mispronouncing that, but whether particular conduct constitutes concerted activity, that term is used in Section 7 of the Act, it's a question for the board, specialized expertise, and this board reviews that board determination only for reasonable. That's not a carte blanche de novo. Let's use our exclusively independent judgment, and we don't care what the board says. Those are two different standards. Don't you agree?
I understand. Yes, sir. I understand that. But the problem that with trying to apply that standard to this evidence is that the conflict in the evidence should be held against Ms. Wright. She's the one that testified.
That argument. If there is a conflict in the evidence, then the board wins. By definition.
I would disagree with that. When
that's simply a statement of fact. If there is a conflict in the evidence, we defer to the board.
No,
that wasn't the question.
The point I was trying to make is that Ms. Gore can't conflict her own testimony. We have to take an admission by a party and give it its due weight. And if there's conflicting testimony, or if there's circumstantial evidence that tends to show that Ms. Gore's own admissions, her own admissions, should be overlooked, you can't do that. She is bound by her sworn testimony.
I understand that point. I guess what you're saying, if she's the one who created the conflict, then we have a different issue. But in terms of how we review this evidence on appeal, I don't think it's accurate to say that we get a complete do-over.
I agree with that. You don't get a complete do-over. What I'm saying is her admissions constitute evidence that cannot be overcome, and therefore you have the authority to make a legal decision that based on her admissions, there was no protected concerted activity for the mutual aid or benefit of other employees.
I see what you're saying. We would have to find that what she said couldn't be read together. We would have to find that there was inconsistent.
I understand that, Your Honor, and that's why I say her testimony that she acted solely on her own behalf and solely for her own benefit is sufficient evidence for that. I mean, it is an admission by the primary party in this case that she doesn't meet the prima facie case for protected concerted activity or the mutual aid or protection of more than one employee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will come down and recount and proceed directly to the next meeting.